Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaru Thadi. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaru Thadi. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Rangana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Rangana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jayo Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jayo Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaru Thadi Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaru Thadi Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jayo Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jayo Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Om Vishnupad Paramahansa Parivrajika Acharya Shtottara Sutta Shri Srimad His Divine Grace Today Se Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai Gantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Nitai Gaur Premanande Hari Hari Bol Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Agarish the Assemble Devotee Agarish the Assemble Devotee Agarish the Assemble Devotee Agarish the Shri Shri Guru Gauranga There's a nice verse in glorification of Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam has quite a few verses in glorification of the Bhagavatam sprinkled throughout. This one is from the second chapter, text number 7. Text number 5. Pravishta karna randhena swanam bhava saroruham dunoti shamalam krishna salilasya yata sharat. The sound incarnation of Lord Krishna, the Supreme Self, i.e. Srimad Bhagavatam, enters into the heart of a self-realized devotee, sits on the lotus flower of his loving relationship, and thus cleanses the dust of material association, such as the dust of material association, such as lust, anger, and hankering. Thus it acts like autumnal rains upon pools of muddy water. This comes before more familiar verse, at least to me. Nice verse. Dautatma purusha krishna paramulam namunchati mukta sarva parikresha panta swashadanam yata. A pure devotee of the Lord whose heart has once been cleansed by the process of devotional service never relinquishes the lotus feet of the Lord, for they fully satisfy him, as a traveler is satisfied at home after a troubled journey. Yeah, I used to quote it back when I remembered verses. My practice used to be remembering them. Now my practice is forgetting them. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 21, Conversation between Manu and Kardama, text number 51. So, word meanings. Ya, you who. So, this is Kardama Muni is speaking to Swayambhuva Manu, who has just arrived there with his wife and daughter and entourage. So, actually, the etiquette is that the superior speaks first. So we have a king who's a kshatriya and a sage who's a brahmin. So the kshatriya arrives and he comes before the sage, but he doesn't say anything. The sage speaks first because he's a brahmin. He's in the superior position. That would be the etiquette. It's like if you went to see Prabhupada, you wouldn't go in and just start talking. You go and sit there and then Prabhupada would say, so? He would say something or ask you to say something. What do you want? That's the proper etiquette. If you're the junior and approaching a senior, you let the senior speak first. So that's what's being demonstrated here. That's one point. So, yeah, you who, Arka of the sun, Indu of the moon, Agni, the fire god, Indra, of Indra, the Lord of Heaven, Vayu Nam, of Vayu, the Wind God, Yama, of Yama, the God of Punishment, Dharma, of Dharma, the God of Piety, Pratyeta Sam, and of Varuna, the God of the Waters, Rupani, the Forms, Stane, when necessary, Adhutse, you assume, Tasmai, unto him, Shuklaya, unto Lord Vishnu, Te, unto you, Nama, obeisances. So this form of Lord Vishnu is called Shukla. Shukla means white, so I don't know. Anyway. So we'll chant. Yorkendwagnindravayunam. Yama dharma prachetasam Rupani sthana adhutse Tasmai shuklaya te namaha Yorkendvagnindra vayunam Yama dharma prachetasam Rupani sthana adhutse Tasmai Shuklaya Te Namaha. Yokin Dwagni Dravayunam Yama Dharma Prachetasam Rupani Sthana Adhatse Tasmai Shuklaya Te Namaha Yokin Dwagni Dravayunam Yama Dharma Prachetasam Upanishtana Abhutse Tasma Shuklaya Te Namaha Yokendvagni Dhra Yama Dharma Prachetasam Upanishtana Abhutse Tasmai Shuklaya Te Namaha Andidra Vayunam Yama Dharma Prachetasam Rupani Sthana Adhatse Tasmai Shuklaya Te Namaha Yokendvagnindra Vayunam Yama Dharma Prachetasam Upani Sthana Adhatse Tasmai Shuklaya Te Namaha Yokendvagnindra Vayunam Yama Dharma Prachetasam Upani Sthana Adhatse Tasmai Shuklaya Te Namaha. Translation: You assume, when necessary, the part of the sun god, the moon god, Agni, the god of fire, Indra, the lord of paradise, Vayu, the wind god, Yama, the god of punishment, Dharma, the god of piety, and Varuna, the god presiding over the waters. All obeisance is to you, who are none other than Lord Vishnu. Purport. Since the sage Kardama was a Brahmana and Swayambhuva was a Kshatriya, the sage was not supposed to offer obeisances to the king because socially his position was greater than the king's. But he offered his obeisances to Swayambhuva Manu because as Manu, king and emperor, he was the representative of the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord is always worshipable, regardless of whether one is a Brahmana, a Kshatriya, or a Shudra. As the representative of the Supreme Lord, the king deserved respectful obeisances from everyone. Om jnana timirandhasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurun militamena tasmai shri gurave namaha. And Prabhupada takes this that Manu is, you might say, the personification. He says, what does he say? The part. Well, he says, you play there. Well, no, he doesn't actually say that. He says, you assume when necessary the part of the sun god. Part, I assume, is like a, you know, part in the play, a role. You play their role. You do what they do when necessary. You have that power. But then he says, all obeisances to you who are none other than Lord Vishnu. So he's worshiping the king. The king is as Prabhupada is pointing out, is a representative of the Lord. We often find statements like this. The representative is not only representing, but in some sense is that person. Just like, of course, the guru is representing Krishna and is honored just as Krishna is honored. I'm going to read Chakravarti Thakur, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on this. He presents it slightly differently. Actually, I just wanted to mention one thing here. We notice that there are two different words here. We have Yama and Dharma. So, of course, Yamaraj is often called Dharmaraj. But here we have two different personalities, Yama and Dharma. It's interesting because I have at home this Vedic encyclopedia. Picked it up in India long ago. It's a big, thick book, and it has all kinds of... It's drawn from the Puranas, and it's basically, it was like an encyclopedia. It talks about all the personalities that appear within the... especially the Puranas and the Itihasas, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. So the person who compiled that, he makes a point of saying that Dharmaraj and Yamaraj are two different people. So we often think of them as the same person. And in one sense, I think it's okay to say that they're the same person because Yamaraj is Dharmaraj also, although there may be another person called that. Yamaraj, of course, has the qualities of Dharmaraj. He's overseeing the whether people are sticking to their dharma or not. So in any case, I thought that was interesting that both of their names are mentioned here. So this is what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, this is his commentary on this verse. You means Manu, you completely, there must be a word here that begins with a long A. You completely accept the forms of the sun and others in a suitable way, stani. You are the sun because of your majesty. So now he's pointing out how he is these things because he has these different qualifications or qualities that are especially prominent in these demigods. So you are the sun because of your majesty. Now, I don't have the Sanskrit, so I don't know what word he's translating as majesty. We might think Aishwarya, but I'm not sure. You are the moon because of your fame. So fame is usually yasha. So first I thought, the moon is famous. I guess you can't. Everybody knows the moon. How can you not know the moon, right? Everyone knows the moon because we see it. So you're the moon. So the moon, in some sense, represents fame. The moon is famous. You are fire because of your invincibility. So that's, of course, a great quality of fire. When fires start, can get quite scary, actually. I know I have experience growing up when we were kids. We used to, in the springtime, we'd play baseball in someone's field, and the grass would get too long, so we'd light it on fire. And year after year, it would get out of control. We'd have to call in the fire department. We'd start going, oh, no, we lost it again. So fires can be quite invincible. You are Indra because of your lordship. Of course, Indra means the king or the lord. So Manu, he has great power also. He's ruling over something. It's not always clear to me exactly what he rules over. Sometimes it said the universe. You are Vayu because you enter everywhere. So air goes everywhere. There's an example that's given where it's talking about the difference between the body and the soul. I forget where it is. I was reading it recently in the Bhagavatam. And it says the soul exists after the body is finished just as the air continues to exist. So whatever air was within that body, it goes on. It doesn't die with the body, you can say. So similarly, the soul, the being, the self, the life, it doesn't die when the body is finished. So Vayu, you're Vayu because you enter everywhere. You are Yama because you punish the sinful. The word yama, of course, means to control. In Ashtanga Yoga, we have yama niyama. So yama that means the what to do and what not to do. So these are both actually about controlling ourselves. So Yamaraj means he's the king of controllers. If you can't control yourself, he'll help you out. Ultimately, he controls you, and there's nothing you can do about it. I sometimes think of this as, especially for non-devotees, they don't know what's going to happen. That's why death could be so scary, right? They don't know if it's the end, or if it's not the end, what comes next. So I think like that too. I say, I'm not quite sure what's going to come next for me. And one thing I know for sure, it's going to be out of my control. Something's going to be happening. Sometimes we have these images of like falling through a tunnel, you know. What can you do when you're falling through that tunnel? There's nothing you can do. You can scream for help or whatever, but it's out of your control. So yama, what happens to you at death, just like we saw, of course, Ajamil was rescued, but he was so afraid. Prabhupada uses the adjective awkward looking. So they're more than just awkward looking, they're fierce looking, they're afraid. It's like if some, you know, grizzly bear comes after you and you're walking down a trail in the woods. So just imagine that multiplied many times. That's how scary it is when the Yamadutas show up. Sometimes we hear about stories of people on their deathbed, all of a sudden they get extremely afraid and something's happening to them. So Yama, you are Yama because you punish the sinful. Actually, Prabhupada would point out how people, there should be some, you might say, a little healthy fear of the government. You know, you're going to get in trouble if you, that comes up in the Prithu, all the pastime of Prithu Maharaj. King is supposed to be strong to curb down the sinful persons who are terrorizing the citizens. So Yama is like that, and his representatives, awkward-looking representatives. You are Dharma because you protect the righteous. You are Varuna because you are deep and have hidden treasure. Isn't that interesting? Because Varuna, of course, he lives within the water. And we know how Nanda Maharaj was taken to his abode within the water somehow. There's a very, what is the Maya? I think it's Apamaya, I think is the phrase, which means made of water. It comes up in the fifth canto. And Prabhupada translates it. He says that Vayu's form is made of water. That's the way Prabhupada presents it, which literally is that's what it means, apamaya. So, you know, so many inconceivable things going on in this universe. So because you are deep and have hidden treasure, who knows what's at the bottom of the ocean? Sometimes people talk about this, the great unexplored. Actually, there's so many places, even on this planet, where no one has ever been. Who knows what's there in so many of these places? Of course, now we have satellite images, but still, there are so many remote places. Most of the world is actually wilderness. Huge. Like when you're flying from India and you go over like the Middle East, that area, you see Afghanistan, all these places, just nothing, just dry mountains. And so the ocean is like that too. Who knows what's down there? Sometimes you see these strange creatures that are there, but it hasn't really been deeply explored. And it's also, of course, there are jewels there. There are riches there. And there's a fire there too. You know, there's one of the fires is called Vadava. One of the forms of, I guess it's a form of Agni, or at least it's one form of fire, the Vadava fire. There, the Vadava is feminine, and she's the mother of the Ashwini Kumars. So anyway, so this is the end of Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. Therefore, I offer respects to you, the Lord in another form, who have come to my cottage. So this is the main point of today's verse that Srila Prabhupada brings out. I read some Prabhupada more elaboration on this idea of the king as the representative of God. This is from a purport to 4:16:20. Another significant word in this verse is Nara Deva. As described in the previous verse, the qualified king be he King Prithu or any other king who rules over the state as an ideal king, so this is from one of the chapters on King Prithu's pastimes, should be understood to be God in human form. According to Vedic culture, the king is honored as the supreme personality of Godhead because he represents Narayana, who also gives protection to the citizens. He is therefore Nata, or the proprietor. Even Sanatan Goswami gave respect to Nawab Hussein Shah as Nutadev, although the Nawab was Mohammedan. A king or governmental head must therefore be so competent to rule over the state that the citizens will worship him as God in human form. I guess some people worship Trump like that. But he doesn't deserve it. We'll hear a little bit more about this. That is the perfectional stage for any head of government or state. Here's Prabhupada talking about Machiavelli in the philosophy book. According to Vedic civilization, a king is worshipped as God in human form and is therefore called Nutadeva. If the good qualities are lacking in a king, he can no longer be considered Nutadeva. So you're not Nutadeva just because you're in the post. And he cannot rule very long because his rule is artificial. He doesn't belong there, so he gets kicked out. That's how democracy works, because none of them belong there, right? Therefore, in Kali Yuga, the royal order is finished, Prabhupada says. That's why we don't have kings, because they were supposed to represent God, and they're not, so just get rid of the whole thing. Now here Prabhupada talks about this. He mentioned about Sanatan Goswami glorifying, he gave respect to Nawab Hussein Shah as Nutadeva. Here Prabhupada's talking about that. When Nawab Hussein Shah was inquiring about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, so this is when Lord Chaitanya went to Ramakeli, where Nawab Hussein Shah was ruling from there, apparently, that area where Rupa and Sanatan lived. When Nawab Hussein Shah was inquiring about, so the Shah heard that this prophet or whatever he was, saintly person, was in his kingdom, especially his town. And so he was hearing about it, and he was attracting so many people. So he was asking Sanatan Goswami about it. So he was inquiring, this person is not ordinary person. We are kings. Sometimes when we give in charity, so many men flock around us. But here is a person, wherever he's going, thousands of men are following him. So he's not ordinary person. End quote. After all, he's a king. He has got intelligence, Prabhupada's saying. Even from diplomatic point of view, the king can understand. So he inquired from his minister, Sanatan Goswami, so who is this person? So Sanatan Goswami replied, whom you accept as, there's some word, it says indistinct here, Paya something, the prophet is he. It is your fortune that during your reign he has taken birth in Bengal. You are governor. You are king of Bengal. Why are you asking me? You are king. You are representative of Krishna. You ask your mind and you'll understand what he is. So he, Sanatan, gave the certificate immediately. He certified the king as a representative of Krishna. Not that, Prabhupada continues, not that, oh, you are a Mohammedan. What can you know? No, Mohammedan, Hindu, doesn't matter. If one is king, he must be blessed by Krishna. So this is another angle Prabhupada is presenting here. If he is king, he must be blessed by Krishna. He has been given the opportunity to become, and if the king also remembers that I am representative of God, God has given me this post to rule over this country, to make them dharmic, to follow, to understand Krishna consciousness, then that is my duty, first duty. Then everything is all right. So it's by Krishna's mercy that one gets the post. So in that sense, you're representing Krishna, you're representing Krishna's mercy. But you have to actually perform the responsibilities of the king, which Prabhupada points to here. He talks about it more in other places. The king's main responsibility is to make the citizens dharmic. In other words, make them Krishna conscious. That's really what they're supposed to do. Set up a system, or the system is already there, of course, in Varnashram. But make the state favorable for people to advance in Krishna consciousness, and also teach them in different ways. Let me leave this a little more from Prabhupada. So the king or the emperor is representative of Krishna. Therefore, he is so honored, Naradeva. The king's another name is Naradeva, God as human being. The king is so respected because he is representative of Krishna. Any representative of Krishna, so there are many different kinds of representatives of Krishna. Here Prabhupada is talking about a particular one. I'll say a little something about others. Just as king, not the present king or president, but this is the ideal. He should be so perfect representative. It is said by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Yasya Prasada Bhagavat Prasada. So, of course, this is from Guru Vashtakam, and it's in the context of the spiritual master. But Prabhupada is quoting it, and then he says, if the king is real representative of God, then simply by pleasing the king, you please the Almighty Father God. We hear stories, of course, how in Vedic culture, even in other cultures, how the king was so respected. Practically, people, to see the king was just out of this world. So, especially if the king had good character, the people would be very pleased by his reign and making their lives happy and prosperous and so on. So, representing God in a nice way. So then Prabhupada says, so why Krishna wanted this battle of Kurukshetra to install Maharaj Yudhisthira on the throne? Because he knew that he is my right representative, not the Duryodhana. Therefore, there must be fight. And this Duryodhana and company should be finished. And Yudhisthira should be installed. December 1973, Los Angeles. This reminds me of something I just heard recently. Actually, I heard Ridhananda Maharaj, I was listening to some of his recent classes. And he mentioned that, just sort of incidentally, he says it's interesting that actually the Pandavas aren't really Kurus. The whole fight was because Yudhisthira was supposedly the right successor. But when you think about it, their parents were demigods, not Pandu. And their mother was a Yadu, actually. So, who were they? I was thinking, how many people knew that they were children of demigods? Was that common knowledge, or just certain people knew about that? So, in any case, I was thinking, well, Duryodhana could have argued, well, you're not Kurus, because your fathers are demigods. I don't know if he knew that, but it's kind of an interesting point. They were not actually, you might say, because their parents, their father, was not a Kuru. So now to talk about other kinds of respect. There are so many places where you hear about giving great respect to other living entities in the Bhagavatam. For example, there's that line, Atiti Devo, Atiti, what is it? Devo. I'm missing a word, but anyway, the idea is that the Atiti, the unexpected guest, or uninvited guest, sometimes it's translated, but someone who just shows up at your door, is to be treated just like God. God has arrived in my home, so I have to treat this person just like God. Atiti Devo Bhava, that's the word, the phrase. Atiti Devo Bhava. So, now here's, this verse is from the 11th canto. This is even more inclusive of who is to be respected. How to respect them. This is Krishna in the Uddhava Gita, speaking to Uddhava. And this is actually from the chapter on Bhakti Yoga. There's chapters on Bhakti Yoga and Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga in the 11th canto. Krishna's speaking on all these different topics. Uddhava Gita is sort of like an expanded Bhagavad Gita. Krishna gets into a lot of detail on some of these topics. So in the chapter on Bhakti Yoga, he says this. Disregarding the ridicule of one's companions, one should give up the bodily conception and its accompanying embarrassment. One should offer obeisances before all, even the dogs, outcasts, cows, and asses, falling flat upon the ground like a rod. So, what do you think of that? So this is the BBT purport to that. Now they don't really, let's say, soften it a little, or anything. They say, one should practice seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead within all creatures. This comes up in the Daksha Yajna episode, where it's said there, actually, it's in a purport, or maybe it's in the verse too, where it says that one actually is offering obeisances to the super soul. One should think that way when one offers obeisances to other, especially human beings. So anyway, this goes on. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu advised all devotees to consider themselves lower than a blade of grass and to be more tolerant than a tree. I often think of this. I say, boy, we have such a high high ideals, lower than a great blade of grass. How can you get any lower than that? That's a really intense humility. It's hard to imagine. In fact, people think, well, how could you, you know, you have to have a little self-esteem at least, right? So how do these things go together? But we have these metaphors, lower than a blade of grass. That's pretty low. Even if you're offering obeisances, you're still going to be higher than the blade of grass. So anyway, so they go on. In such a humble position, one will not be disturbed in the prosecution of pure devotional service to the Lord. So if you have extreme humility, then apparently nothing bothers you. A devotee does not foolishly think that a cow or an ass is God, but rather the devotee sees the Supreme Lord within all creatures, and on this higher spiritual plane, he does not discriminate. So that's the way, of course, many places it's seen. You're supposed to see Krishna within the heart of everyone. Krishna, this is one of Krishna's teachings in the Bhagavad Gita. I often think like that when I'm out in public and I look at people and I think, boy, it's not an easy thing to do. How do you do that exactly? Just imagine when you're a conditioned soul, sadhana, sadhaka, trying to advance in Krishna consciousness, how do you apply that principle? Of course, one way we apply it is because we try to help the people spiritually. That's how, that you might say, practical demonstration of seeing the super soul, or at least and seeing the soul and the super soul within everyone. But to have direct actual realization of that, like we had the illustration in the Gita, right? The sage is looking and he's seeing Paramatma in everyone's heart. Well, that takes some practice for sure, more than just practice, real clarity of the heart, pure in the most literal sense, completely pure heart. So then, this is what Vishnu Chaturvarti Thakur says about that verse, this verse about falling flat before even dogs, outcasts, cows, and asses. This verse describes a practice of one who naturally sees me everywhere. One should disregard friends who ridicule, saying, look, that great person is offering respects to a low creature. So he's taking it literally in this verse. One should give up bodily conceptions such as, I am elevated, he is fallen. How can I offer respects to him? By that bodily conception, one develops embarrassment. Giving up that embarrassment, one should offer respects even to dogs and chandalas, since one sees only the Lord present everywhere. So this seems to be something that an avaduta would do, because obviously, like he says here, don't be embarrassed, just go offer your obeisances to dogs. So I don't know what to make of things like this. So then there's another verse. This is in the, I don't have the verse here exactly, but it's in the seventh canto. It's in the chapter called Ideal Family Life, which I think is chapter 14th of the 17th chapter. Yudhishthira Maharaj, he asked about Varnashram after the Nrsingha Leela and another little interlude. Then he asks, the whole seventh canto is Narada Muni is speaking to Yudhishthira at the Rajasuya sacrifice. So everything that's being spoken there is out in the open. There's a whole audience there. All the people who attended the Rajasuya, those who are still around, they're hearing Yudhishthira question Narada Muni. So they, from Narada Muni, they're hearing the whole story. They heard the whole story of Nrsingadev, the whole Nrsingadev pastime. Then it goes on after that. So Yudhishthira, he asks about Varnashram. And first, Narada Muni talks about renunciation, the renounced ashrams. He talks about brahmacharya, sannyas, vanaprastha. So then he says, well, what about us lowly grihasthas? What advice do you have for us? So in the context of that, there's a verse that says that one should, now I don't remember what word is used exactly, but the basic idea is that one, well, the way Prabhupada translates it, one phrase in his translation, is that one should, the creatures that appear in your house, whatever they are, lizards or mice or whatever, ants or flies or whatever is in your house, Prabhupada said one should treat them exactly as one treats one's old children, because actually there's not much difference. More or less, that's what he said. So I listen to the Bhagavatam, and I, every time I hear this, I think, exactly? This is one of those examples where Prabhupada uses words where he says, well, I don't know if he really means exactly. Because, you know, you don't put a little suit on the mouse and send him off to school with his book bag, or, you know, how can you cheat all these creatures exactly like one's own children? So maybe, I think when we hear these things, we naturally just sort of filter them ourselves without even realizing that we're doing it. We don't take it 100% literally, because what exactly means, literally, exactly, obviously you can't treat. So what Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, this is what he says. Here it is. I do have Prabhupada's here. I'm sorry. He says, one should treat animals such as deer, camels, asses, monkeys, mice, snakes, birds, and flies exactly like one's own son. How little difference there actually is between children and these innocent animals. Now, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he doesn't say one treats them exactly, but he does say, he said the application of this is that one feeds them. So then I thought, well, even that, I had an experience just last night? Yeah. We have devotees over for a reading, and we have a small bathroom right in our entryway. Sometimes it gets used. So I went in there, and there's this big brown snake that's been hanging out in that little bathroom behind the toilet. And I just leave him alone, but I think, well, some devotee may come in here and get, you know, not like to see this big spider in here. So I was saying, well, what should I do? It's hard, I couldn't, you know, get to him. But we had the toilet bowl brush there, and it's in this little stand thing that kind of closes up when you put the brush in. So I just spooked the spider, and he went into that little mechanism, and I just bent down, and I closed it up, and I took him outside and threw him away. I thought, well, that worked out pretty well. But then I thought, oh, I forgot to feed him. I'm supposed to feed him first. I didn't feed him. So I was thinking, actually, I guess the best thing is you feed them the holy name, chant to them. It reminded me of there are different pastimes of Prabhupada with little creatures, right? Like he told Govinda Dasi to bow down to some, I forget what it was, some bug in Prabhupada's room. She got down on her hands and knees, and she was chanting Hare Krishna to this insect. Another time, Prabhupada was sitting in his room, and then he said to someone who was there, there was a bug on a leaf, and he said, I think this bug is hungry. Give him something to eat, or take him outside so he can eat, or something like that. So Prabhupada was seeing that. He was concerned about every creature. Actually, in Prabhupada's purport to one of these verses I read about this, I think it's this one, this last one, about these different creatures. He talks about how his main point in the purport is how people are just so callous about killing animals. He mentions pesticides, for example, which is interesting. And of course, to live in the material world is hard to live without killing. I often think of this, actually. I don't exactly know the answer, but or maybe I have somewhat of an answer. One little girl asked me many years ago, I was at a devotee's house, and the little girl, she said, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it was something like, what happens to devotees who, because we are always killing things, like there are so many dead bugs on our windshield, and so, something like that. So my reply was something like, well, we have to always be acting for Krishna, then we'll be protected. So, you know, you can extend that and saying, yeah, if I'm driving to do something Krishna conscious, even maintaining my household, which is supposed to be a temple of Krishna, everything that goes on there is supposed to be, Krishna is the owner of the house. And but if I'm, you know, driving my car to go to the movies, maybe, I don't know, how is Krishna going to be liberal if I'm going driving my car just to go do some nonsense? Maybe not. So, and of course, Prabhupada did, you know, when Prabhupada got sick, he said it was because his disciples were committing sins, actually. In other words, there was still some reaction to what devotees were doing, but he said the spiritual master accepted it. He gave it as, a, you know, he said he was sick because of his disciples weren't following the regulative principles. So, anyway, I just made the connection between this, that we're not supposed to hurt anyone. Even the creatures come into your house, you're supposed to accommodate them somehow. You know, it's hard to imagine just going to let a snake live in your house, but in any case. But you have to treat them. You don't kill them. That's one thing. You know, this story, there was a walk in at the manor, I think it was. At least it was in England, and there was some problem with the rats. And I think they were asking Prabhupada whether they could kill them, and Prabhupada said, no, you should be killed. And then usually Prabhupada would make the point, if you get these uninvited creatures like this, because you're not clean. You're getting the rats because you're not clean, or you're getting the roaches because you're not clean, and so on. So do that. Don't think about them. That's like when he was in, of course, this is a more stark example, when Prabhupada was at Gita Nagari, and the devotees, they were faced with the problem. You do, if you want milk, you have to keep breeding the cow. The cow has to give a calf, and then they give milk for some time. So they were accumulating more and more cows, and they didn't know how to, they were trying to get an answer from Prabhupada. What do you do? How do you manage this exactly? So I don't remember exactly what Prabhupada said, but the last thing he said was, just don't kill them. Don't think we have to kill them now because we have too many cows. So figure it out. There are ways to do these things, but don't kill them. He was concerned about that. So that was always Prabhupada's mood. Of course, there's another famous example of killing where at the Dallas Gurukul, there was a tree that was, apparently an old tree that was starting to fall towards the building, I think, and devotees decided to cut it down. Prabhupada saw that it had been done, and he wasn't happy about it, actually. He told them they shouldn't have done it. They should have made some arrangement so the tree could keep standing and not just... So it seems like Prabhupada saw it as maybe we were too callous about it or nonchalant about it. Oh, just cut down the tree. It's not a big deal. But for him, it was. No, this tree has been standing there for a long time. It has its karma. It's living out its punishment, you can say. But don't interfere with that. So in any case, so this is the idea that offering respect, this is all in the context, you can say, of offering respect to all kinds of living entities. Prabhupada himself, he was so respectful of everything. I often think of this actually in the, you know, you're not supposed to do anything with your feet basically, except play soccer maybe. And you don't move things with your feet. I often wonder about, should we even do it with these mats that are on the floor? Or maybe we should use our hands and not our feet to move them. It's interesting because it's not only that the feet are dirty, but it kind of shows some kind of disrespect to use your feet to do something. I think on the altar, well, you're probably not going to, because you want to stay clean, you don't want to touch the mat with your hands. So maybe that's different, but in other instances, better not to use your feet. Sometimes I always think, there's so many things that are inconceivable to me. I wonder, is Prabhupada seeing everything that I do? Is he with Krishna, just running through the fields with Krishna? Is he doing both things simultaneously? If I move something with my foot, does Prabhupada know? I don't know. I don't know how these things work. It's all a great mystery to me. Different things I read too, it makes it hard to understand. We do know that Krishna's parishads, his most intimate devotees, they can appear in different. I spoke of this just my last class. They can be with Krishna in so many different circumstances at the same time. Krishna can be in so many places, in so many forms, and his devotees can be assisting him in different forms, in different places at the same time. This is an amazing thing. So what it's like to be a self-realized soul, even that, just to realize that you're not this body, what it means to realize that you are pure consciousness, what is that experience like? That's why I said you can't understand the mind of the pure devotee, the mind and the actions, because he's existing on a different platform that we don't have access to as conditioned souls. Maybe some of you do, but I can't claim that I have any kind of experience like that of another level of consciousness. So that whole world is such a mystery to us because we don't, because we're covered by Krishna's, by the three modes of material nature, and we're essentially blind to it. So anyway, that's kind of a sidetrack. I wonder what the spiritual master, after he departs, what he knows about his disciple in the material world. Does he see all of our indiscretions? Does he know if I just licked a stamp? he would chide his servants for doing things like that, you know. But in any case, so we need to follow Prabhupada's overall mood and advice in this regard and be respectful of things, seeing Krishna in everything. That's another thing that comes up in so many places I read, where it says Krishna is this. Because it's his energy, it is Krishna. Yeah, we see so many prayers of glorification of, especially Lord Vishnu in the Bhagavatam. You are the water, you are the sun, you are the this, you are the that, over and over again. Because it's his energy, and Krishna is non-different from his energy. So the pure devotee, of course, Prabhupada, he demonstrated that himself. He could see Krishna everywhere, therefore he was so concerned that everything was respected and taken care of properly. All right, verse again. And this is one of those stuck together all these Sundays. Your kendvagnindra vayunam yama dharma prachetasam rupani sthana adhutse tasmai shuklayate namaha. You assume when necessary the part of the sun god, the moon god, Agni, the god of fire, Indra, the lord of paradise, Vayu, the wind god, Yama, the god of punishment, Dharma, the god of piety, and Varuna, the god presiding over the waters. All obeisances to you, who are none other than Lord Vishnu. Here's another example of that, directly glorifying Manu as being Vishnu in person. He calls him Shuklaya, which is Lord Vishnu. Tasmai Shuklaya Te Namaha, unto you who are Lord Vishnu, basically. Actually, it's interesting. Prabhupada often, when he talked about the Manvantars, it seemed like sometimes he talked about Manu as a Manvantar, but they're actually two different things. The Manvantar avatar. So there's an avatar for each Manu, but a Manu is also, as a representative of Krishna, is also considered a kind of avatar, vibhuti, especially a vibhuti of Lord Krishna, which is also considered to be Krishna. So both the Manu himself and the Manvantara avatar are both a kind of avatar. Okay. The Vikram.
Manvantara also means the reign of a Manu. That's the thing. So in the Manu
Samhita, Manvantar, yeah, you're just explaining the word Manvantar.
Reign, yeah.
Manvantar is the reign of a Manu.
Yeah. The Manu Samhita gives the detailed explanation of the king. He says the king is Naradev, representative of the Supreme, but he's sum total of all the demigods too. That's why I was wondering, you know, how it's...
Prabhupada always takes it as...
And he says...
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. Many places, there are many, because I was looking, I was going through the Vedabase and looking through instances of this Naradev, and a lot of times in the word for word, it says Naradev, and Prabhupada just translates it as king. So it's a synonym for king, you can say. And of course, you could take a deva, you could say, okay, demigods, but generally Prabhupada took it as God, representative of God in that context. That was Prabhupada's standard way of taking the word.
Really, really, God should be ruling the earth, but because he is not here, the king is doing the job of what God should be doing, you know. So that's why he says that the king is the is called Naradeva.
Yeah.
And then it's some total of the thing. And he says, without the king, the strong would advantage the weak like the shark in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, if there's not a king in a country, run as fast as possible. You know, because then advantage would be taken in that country, chaos would be there. See, so the king is very important. So Manu here is, I guess that's why he's being glorified like that.
Actually, people are happy under a good king. Problem is, they tend to absolute power corrupts absolutely, as it said.
But we see some people take advantage of it, like King Benna.
Yeah.
He took advantage of that position, that I'm God.
The amazing thing about that story is that the Brahmins put him in that position.
Yes.
And it said the minister disagreed. What are you doing? You know, this guy kills his playmates. You know, you're making him the king. It does seem a little strange. Seems like it's just all part of the for the Leela to play out, Prithu Maharaj's Leela.
I remember the verse, Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave a commentary on Eko Pasho Rachaitam Jagadanda Koti.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Shakti Shakti Mata, both are one simultaneously, yet we say he is distinct from his energy, mm-hmm. from his illusion, because Jiva Goswami Pad says that Adai Paratattva is four. The Lord, his incarnation, manifestation, unlimited creation, then Jiva and the Maya, all together is Paratattva. But then Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave a commentary, but he's distinct from all. We have to always focus that.
A lot of the Bhagavatam has Mayavad philosophy. In other words, oneness. There's a lot of verses that emphasize the oneness, actually. And you can see how the... In fact, I was just reading... this wasn't a quote from the Bhagavatam, but it was a quote from the Vedas. It was in the Hari Bhakti Vilas. I happen to be reading some of it. There's a Vaishnava, a devotee scholar, Bhrigupad, who is translating the... what is our... I'm trying to forget that. Our... it's has all the rules and regulations. What is it? I'm not hearing.
Smartibha Shatadam Vishnu.
Hari Bhakti Vilas. Okay, Hari Bhakti Vilas. Sorry. Hari Bhakti Vilas. So this devotee is presenting. He's an academic, a devotee. Bhrigupad, his name is Mans Bru. But anyway, I was reading some of that, and he quotes his verse, and he says it. He's explained that Sanatana Goswami is commenting on the book. There's a whole introduction about who actually wrote it. He's convinced it was Sanatana, and Sanatana also wrote the commentary. So he's quoting, Sanatana quotes this Veda, and then he says, in a footnote, he says, and he's giving Sridhar Swami, he's quoting Sridhar Swami's commentary on this verse, but he's leaving out the second part, because the second part is impersonalism. So Sanatana is quoting Sridhar's commentary that we can use, but he's leaving out the part that's clearly impersonalism. So there's a lot of that, actually. There's a lot of verses that are, you know, on the face of it, they're talking about the oneness of everything and false. Like, you know, we Prabhupada would tend to say it's temporary but not false, but he himself even uses the word false sometimes in his translations of some of the verses. This material world is insubstantial, in the, which is basically what the Mayavadis say. It's not really here. There's no substance to it. So we don't say that, but there are verses in the Bhagavatam that say essentially that, or at least even Prabhupada has translated them that way. So we actually have this kind of, you know, eternal tension between these two ideas. And that's why, you know, we say achintya bheda bheda tattva, because you have to accept both of them, because they're both there. Ultimately, our authority is the Vedas, the Upanishads, especially for the philosophy. And the Vedas say that everything is one, But the Vedas also show that everything is not one, that there is duality too. So the Mayavadis, they only take the statements, you know, they hang their hat on the statements that talk about oneness, but we say, no. The Vedas also, they say this, Dva Suparna Sayuja Sakaya, there are two birds and the tree, and you know, so many others. So these things are both there. We can't say, no, it's not that everything is one. Yes, actually, in one sense, everything is one. Even Brahman, of course, the three aspects of Krishna, Brahman, Paramatman, and Bhagavan, really, they're all Brahman. Just different ways of looking at it, different perspectives, you can say, or different manifestations. Ekam Brahma Dutiya Nasti. I mean, that says directly, that verse, Mayavadi's like. Ekam Brahma, everything is Brahma, Dutiya Nasti. There's no second thing. Right. Well, it depends.
Brahmavadi, impersonal.
It's the same. Prabhupada sometimes uses the words, you know, in the same, he uses the words in different ways.
But
Brahmavad is Mayavad.
Brahmavadis are not offender. They are impersonal.
Well, that's usually the distinction that we make, yeah. Yes. Because Mayavadis, we don't want to say, we don't want to call the Kumaras Mayavadis, but... But we make that distinction. Yeah, we don't use the word because it's pejorative, Mayavad. But in a sense, they mean the same thing. They're both thinking it's all one. It's only they're both emphasizing the oneness. But generally another way to look at it is we tend to think that the Brahmavadis are on their way up, and the first thing they realize is Brahman, how everything is one, and they have to go higher and not be offensive, otherwise. Aruya Krishna Padam Padam Tadam. They have to take shelter of Krishna from that Brahman platform. So they're innocent and they're progressing up. So we would generally use the more complimentary name Brahmavadis because they're not offensive. The Mayavadis are Aparadhis. So that term has been, you might say, you know, we've given it a strict definition to mean the offensive impersonalists. But the essence of the, you know, is that they're both seeing only oneness. That's the idea, which in a sense is true. Everything is one in one sense. It's all consciousness. So
there is a distinct difference between them. I mean, many, but one of them prominent. I remember Bhagavatam 7.2.6, where Hiranyakashipu was speaking that by the shelter of Maya, he has taken the pig, animal form, killed my brother, so he gave up his mercy. And in that verse actually distinctly says that why he's considered Mayavadi. He said, Brahmavadi, they accept ultimate is impersonal, but also they accept eternal form, also in eternal. They don't say it is origin is impersonal, but they accept the form is eternal. Mayavadi do not accept form is eternal. Form is product of Maya. So Sattagun produce the form of God. Rajagun produce the living entity. Tamagun produce the material creation or mundane world. That is Brahmavadi didn't accept that. So there is a little, big difference in that sense. That's why they are not offended.
Okay. We'll accept that as the closing. Whatever I said that was not quite right, my apologies. It's all chintya to me. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.